Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. I'm along with Mel, K2KEY. We're going to try to run something called the Technical Net tonight. It's a gathering of crazy people who are not watching the Academy Awards, who have an interest in electronics, wireless electronics in particular, and want to know something about how their equipment works and how to make it work better. Their favorite rigs and antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and modes of propagation and whatever. The 26 different kinds of ham radio. Lots of stuff to learn. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a yes or a no, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins tonight? Is there anybody out there not watching the Academy Awards? Give me a call letter and name. K2RIW listening.
W2EWK, I'm not watching the awards. I'm watching the ham radio for you all.
2GRT, not watching it yet. I heard no questions. I'm going to pick you up in a second. W2GRT and Eugene. Mr. GRT, what is your name, sir?
2GOT, Mr. GOT, Howard.
Okay, GOT, Golf Oscar Tango, Howard. Alrighty. And the person saying no questions, who was that?
Bill, WB2CUK, good evening,
sir. By the time we really get rolling, Bill, you're going to have some questions. You wait and see. Okay, anyone else to check in? Give me your call letter and name at this time.
No questions.
With a space report, and the only Oscar I know about is orbital satellite carrying amateur radio. Good evening, Dick.
KC2MTP, Steve, no question.
Question about the lunar eclipse.
W2ITH, no question.
KC2QIQ with a question.
Oh, we got a live one there. QIQ with a real question. ITH, MDP, BIE, all good substantial citizens. I think they all had no questions. Correct me if I'm wrong. Anyone else to check in?
KKND, Rich, and good evening.
WW2WW with a question.
Okay, Rich recognized. WW2. Boy, I want a lot of W's. Okay, Mr. W's, what is your name, sir?
Good evening, Dick. The call is Whiskey, 2 Whiskey, Whiskey. My name is Tim from Keensburg with a question about the lunar eclipse.
Okay, Tim, we're going to pick you up about the lunar eclipse. The only yeses I know so far are Eugene and Tim and QIQ. If I'm wrong, correct me. Anyone else to check in with a question or comment? Give me a call, letter's name, and a yes at this time.
W2JPW, Lou, and yes.
Okay, Lou we got. Anyone else?
WB7AVS, Roberto Rob in New York, and yes, I do.
Okay, Rob with a yes, ABS. More than enough. Let's start off with Eugene. Eugene, what's going on out there in your neighborhood? W2EWK, K2RIW.
Okay
there,
Dick, W2EWK. I'm not watching the rewards, but I just checked in into the net, and I went to the ham press today, and I did pretty good over there. I got one scanner, and I got a Motorola radio. Matter of fact, two of them for $8 only. And I got one pair of family radios, and that's practically about it. Okay, right back to you there, Dick, W2EWK.
Okay. The machine is stuck in the normal mode tonight, so we have to all worry about the 2 or 3 minute timer, whatever it is. And Eugene was doing that. Good luck with those scanners and those radios. So we can pick up some nice hardware. I was there also. And Mel and I will be describing what we saw a little bit later on, as well as some guy named Rich, KNB. He seemed to have something to do with that organization and that facility and that shindig, and it went all rather well. When we get down to him, he's going to tell us what his impression was. Let's see, the next person who I think had a real question was Mr. Tim. WW2, WW. You're right ahead with your question, Tim. K2RIW in the tech net. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, very good. We've spoken before, and I really enjoy the tech net. I observed the lunar eclipse this week more than I ever did before because I'm enjoying a new pair of 20x80 celestial binoculars. And I totally observed the lunar eclipse from a whole new perspective, and really was pretty excited about it. So it made me dig a little bit for some information, and I started seeing about the umbral and the penumbral cones and stuff that what I wanted is just a little bit of clarity of that. My take on this penumbral and unumbral. Is that the prenumbral is when partial of the eclipse begins, and then when it becomes total, it enters into that umbral pattern. That's kind of like the way I'm thinking. Maybe you can clarify me on that. And I was also interested on, I took notice on the angle of the shadow as the shadow came in from like a 730 position and started to cast up across into like the 130 position. Is that the normal eclipse pattern in our geographical area? And I'm also curious a little bit about how come it's red when it's in the umbral. Maybe you could just touch on a few of those spots. I'd be excited to know a little bit more about that. WW2WW.
Okay. I don't claim to be an expert on what I'm about to tell you, Kim. But I'll tell you what I know, and maybe I can sort of hint at what I'm not so sure about. I am a member of the Astronomical Society of Long Island. They may not think so. I'm a little late paying my dues this year, but a good group of guys that meet at New York Institute of Technology almost every single Wednesday night of the week, every single week. Very serious club. When you get to 150 members and 40 of them will show up essentially every single week, and they've been doing that now for the last 10 years, either got a guest speaker or a tape about astronomy that they play, or members will show their favorite books, or they'll display what their fancy digital camera connected to their great big oscilloscope is doing, telescope I should say. A past president of that club has built with his own hands a 33-inch diameter mirror, and he built it twice because the first one cracked. That's John Vogt. So a very serious club, and so if you really have an interest in astronomy, I do recommend you attend some of those meetings. They'll welcome with open arms. Just show up, as I said, on Wednesday night at 8:30. It always starts at 8:30, and the main portion of the meeting lasts roughly 1 hour. When you go to Sky and Telescope magazine or their website, and you dial into the section of what should my first oscilloscope or here we go telescope, what telescope should be the first one I buy? They strongly recommend that your first optical instrument be a set of binoculars. Binoculars can give you an awful lot of bang for the dollar. They give you binaural vision. They have very good flexibility, great portability. A person who thinks he's serious in astronomy usually says, gee, I want to buy a zillion-inch diameter scope. I don't care what it costs. And quite often a person like that will lay down a couple thousand dollars, end up with something that's 150 pounds. It is so inconvenient to move, he uses it three times per year. Whereas binoculars, you can put them in the suitcase and take them everywhere you go. So you did the right thing. One of the things I'm going to recommend you do in order to get greater pleasure out of your binoculars, Tim, is that with difficulty, you will eventually find a company that will build for you, that will sell you an object that eventually screws into the front of your binoculars, which you can then put onto a tripod. When you are able to hold a 20x80 binocular, 20 is a nice diameter, a nice magnification, by the way, an 80mm forward lens has got a nice light bucket, as they say. It can gather a lot of light and give you quite a bit of brilliance to the things you look in the sky. And assuming your particular binoculars are properly collimated, that means the left side and the right side aim in the same direction at the same time. And there's a whole procedure you can go through to correct that. There's a whole correction procedure you can go through to correct that if the left side and the right side of your binoculars are not looking at the same thing at the right same time. But being able to mount your binoculars, particularly something bigger than 8x50s, we'll say, or 8x30s, an 8 or 7 magnification binocular can be handheld with a guy with a good steady hand. By the time you get up to 20, You get a much prettier, higher magnification picture. That's the good news. But no hand is steady enough. You're going to get 2, 3, and 4 times more resolution of what you're looking at, the fine details of stars, moon, or whatever, Jupiter, when the binoculars are really being held steady with a good tripod. But the way you mount the binoculars to the tripod, there's an art and science to that. When I went to the show last year, which was the Northeast Astronomy Forum, NEAF, you Google the word NEAF, and they will describe a show that's going to take place at Rockland Community College. I think it takes place in April or May of this year. It's in the gymnasium of that college. It's probably the 10th annual show. There will be 55 or 60 vendors of optical instruments at that show. Everything from high-power laser pointers, great big brand-new design telescopes and microscopes and whatever. Beautiful show. If you have the slightest interest in astronomy, you definitely want to go to NEAF when it's held this coming spring. It'll be an eye-opener for you. But you'll find 2 or 3 guys there selling very crafty-made objects, a strong, sturdy, metallic object that screws into the front of your binoculars, which then screws into your tripod and stands a chance of really holding your binoculars steady. And as such, you're going to get a lot more image out of it. Now, the moon, the lunar eclipse that you saw last Wednesday, I believe it was, takes place some years twice, and some years not at all. I think the very next one, they said, is going to be the year 2010. What's really going on here is that to you and I, the moon looks like an extremely large object. In reality, it's an object that's only a half a degree wide, and you can tell that real fast by a fist held out steady in front of your face, sub 10 degrees. You can prove that by starting off with the bottom of your fist on the horizon and stack the fists one above the other, and by the time you get to the 9th fist, you'll realize you're straight overhead. 9 fists, 90 degrees, 10 degrees per fist. Each finger is roughly 2 degrees, and the moon is half of 1 degree. It's a very small object, relativistically speaking, and a long distance away. The moon's orbit is tilted. In other words, the moon's orbit is not... The moon's orbit is not parallel with our equator. That's the reason why you saw the shadow on the moon start at 7 o'clock and drift toward 1 o'clock, so to speak. The moon was in its orbit, slanting. By the way, almost everything in our solar system viewed top view from our point of view in the northern hemisphere. The people in Australia have got a different point of view, but to you and me in the northern hemisphere, everything viewed in our solar system top view, everything goes counterclockwise with rare exception. Almost all the planets spin counterclockwise. They go around the sun counterclockwise. The moon goes around the earth counterclockwise. So the moon is moving from your right to your left as far as inertial reference in space is concerned. So here's the sun shining on the earth. The earth is casting a shadow that goes out into space. But because the moon is going around the earth in a counterclockwise direction, the moon is sweeping from your right to your left across the shadow of the earth. Because that particular portion of the moon was sweeping from, let's say, upper right toward lower left, because the moon's orbit is tilted with reference to our equator, or with our ecliptic, as you could say, our path around the sun, the moon was drifting from the upper right-hand corner toward the lower left-hand corner. Therefore, it was drifting across the moon's shadow, the Earth's shadow, and that's the reason why you saw the shadow crawl from 7 o'clock toward 1 o'clock. Now, the Earth itself is a object that when you look from the moon toward the Earth, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I think you would see an object that's something like 1 and 3 quarters of a degree diameter. If you're standing on the moon, you look toward the Earth is a much larger object. The Earth as such, not all of it, well, let me backtrack a little bit here. The sun itself is also a object 1/2 degree diameter relativistically. Well, but you stand on the Earth, and with instruments you measure how wide is the moon from your point of view, It's a half a degree. How wide is the sun? It's a half a degree. Because the sun has real width to it, and every bit of it is giving off light, the shadow of the Earth is not a shadow that's exactly the diameter of the Earth. Earth is roughly 8,000 miles in diameter. Common sense would lead you to believe we cast a shadow 8,000 miles in diameter. We cast a kind of a peculiar shadow. If the sun was a point source of light, which had no diameter to it, yes, our shadow would be very close to 8,000 miles diameter. But the sun is an object that's a half degree diameter. Therefore, you get a kind of a fuzzy shadow where it's got a very dark, dark center. That's the umber.
And repeater, timeout, cancel.
And it's got this ring around there that's a penumber. I probably have it backwards. Penumber, but it's got a very dark center, and it's got a slightly less dark annulus or ring around that center of shadow. So the shadow is not a simple point source object. Very similar to what happens if you hold a quarter very close to a piece of paper at high noon, you'll cast a shadow on the paper that's very close to a nice black shadow, exactly the diameter of the quarter. Hold the quarter at your altitude, 5 feet above the ground, because the sun is a
system out.
Okay, because the sun is a half degree diameter object, that shadow of your quarter down on the sidewalk, so to speak, is not going to be a simple black shadow. It's going to have a dark center and a not so dark outer edge, because the sun is not a point source. You can do that experiment tomorrow at high noon if you like. As the moon drifts through that shadow, the first edge is not super dark. It's got kind of a fuzzy edge to it. It's only when the complete center of the shadow drifts across the moon that you get the real darkness, and you're going through this umber and penumber situation. If you Google those particular words with your search engine, guarantee Wikipedia is going to give you all kinds of good information on it. If you go to Sky and Telescope magazine, just to Google Sky and Telescope, I'm not sure, maybe their exact address is skyandtelescope.com or something like that. Let me drop. You'll get lots of information on this particular subject with some nice diagrams. There's lots of good books on it, but the quickest, fastest way for you, Tim, to find out more about it. Astronomy is an interesting science. To some people, it is the purest of all sciences because it's very difficult to earn a dollar with it. Where we came from, how we got here, and what's our ultimate fate in the universe are some non-deep questions that people will spend many lifetimes and not come up with all the complete answers to them. Right now, the leading edge of astronomy research, from my point of view, is gamma ray burst astronomy. And I'll just give you a couple of words as to what that is to whet your appetite. What is a gamma ray burst? Let me drop. You go out and make a measurement. You put a black piece of paper in your backyard at high noon, and you'll find out the sun is giving you something like 1,200 watts per square meter. That's what the solar constant is in your backyard at high noon. Because you know the sun is 93 million miles away, you work out the mathematics, you can figure out real fast how many watts of optical power is coming out of the sun. And it's something like 10 to the 24 power watts. One with 24 zeros after it is the number of watts. The sun is going to last for 10 billion years. The sun is 5 billion years old. So roughly in the middle of the life of the sun. So the sun is going to be putting out 10 to the 24 power watts of power. It's going to do it for 10 billion years. That's a lot of power. Every bit of that gasoline and oil and coal that you burn, you're burning past solar events. You know, they deposited all that material and it eventually became the fuel you're using. And so lots of power comes out of the sun. Can you imagine 10 billion years worth of energy, which is 10 to the 44 joules? There's a lot of seconds in 10 billion years, and it's putting out 10 to the 24 watts each individual second. So 10 billion years worth of energy comes out of a gamma ray burst in approximately 1 second. If that occurs within 22 light years of where you are, you're dead and gone and everything on the planet you're on is fried. Thank goodness most of these gamma ray bursts do not take place in our galaxy. But there are people, I was on a telephone tonight with somebody who is buying antennas in order for him to measure the radio noise that comes out of gamma ray bursts. They're relatively rare events. I think there's roughly one major one per year. But there's some real far-thinking astronomy people who want to catch that energy, measure how much of it is at low frequencies, high frequencies. Let me drop. Optical frequencies and so on, and try to figure out what is it really. The best guess is two neutron stars coming together. And by the way, there's another interesting subject about astronomy. We live in a solar system. We go around a sun. It's our local star. It's the one star that doesn't have a name, or sol, you could call it. But we are going around a unary star, a star all by itself. Unary stars are not the most popular. Binary stars are the most popular. There are more stars where there's a pair of stars going around each other than there are stars that are all alone. So ours are not rare, but it's not the most popular. But when you got two stars going around each other, and they eventually decay in their orbit and come together, all hell breaks loose. If those two particular stars going around each other happen to be neutron stars, white dwarfs, or black holes, well, you get all hell breaking loose to the cube power or the square power, and you get some idea. So people are making some guesses that a gamma ray burst is something really massive, like a neutron star and a black hole, and they come together, and the instant they come together, you get this huge burst of energy. There's some guesses as to what's going on there. I know we drifted pretty far left of your original question, Tim, but as you can tell, I'm kind of enthusiastic about astronomy. You start opening up the right book, you go to the right website, and you meet the right people, and you start going to the right meetings. I think you can have an awful lot of fun with it, and I think equally as much fun as ham radio. Combine ham radio with astronomy, wow, one hell of a combination of hobbies. You go ahead and ask some more questions if you want to, Tim. I know I went pretty far left the field. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I won't take no more time. There's plenty of people out here with lots of questions, but as so is space, so can the discussion be, and it's quite grand. And it all brings me back to the one question of who's the guy that keeps gassing up the sun. And it's fabulous. It's really miraculous, fabulous. It's awe-inspiring. It's certainly combined with amateur radios where I it tickles my fancy because radio is my first love, so... I appreciate your time on it, Dick, and I will look up those things, and thank you very much. This is WW2WW.
Yeah, do, Tim, if you have the slightest interest in astronomy, do at least once go to the Northeast Astronomy Forum, which is a Saturday-Sunday conference at Rockland Community College in Rockland County. Not very difficult to drive there. You go to their particular website, you look up NEAF as a Google, and... they'll give you the list of the vendors, the location, the map, how to get there, the hours, the prices, whatever. And so you just walk up and down those 20 or 15 aisles of all of those vendors, and you look at some of these fancy new telescopes and binoculars and binocular holding devices and chairs for keeping yourself comfortable and warm while you're doing your outdoor astronomy and whatever. You look at all of that hardware. You look at those fancy eyepieces and lenses and mirrors and whatever, and you're going to say, wow. At the fancy cameras, you can connect. You take a modern charge couple device camera, let me drop, and connect it to the eyepiece of a telescope, and that camera is probably 200 or 500 times more sensitive than your eye, and it can integrate the picture for long periods of time, and so you can see things that are a hell of a lot darker with that kind of a camera than your eye will ever see. There are people now with backyard, relatively simple telescopes and cameras that are able to take astronomical photography that's not very different than what Mount Palomar used to be proud to do 30 years ago. Modern day equipment with the right kind of a computer program processing that data can give you pictures that'll just blow your mind. So, another very fun hobby. Okay, the next person who I think had a question was Lou, W2JPW. What's going on over there in your neighborhood, Lou? T2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Good evening. Nice to hear you on here. I have two questions.
You got me.
Enthused about astronomy. I've always been enthused about it, but my eyesight is so bad that I never got into telescopes and things like that. But I'm very interested in cosmology. I think I have every book that... there's a book by Isaacson, I think, about Einstein. He gets a lot of references, and I own all of them. Wish I understood all the math, but at least I understand a little of it. Well, two questions. One is, I was just looking this evening, thinking about it. 40 years ago, I built a switch to try to put together a radiometer, you know, a Dick type with the I-C-K-E, with the, you compare an antenna with either a noise generator or a resistor at a constant temperature. And I just got thinking about it. I still have the switch that I made. It was a capacitive job, and I tried it with a receiver and an oscilloscope. It did work, but I figured in any really serious application, even back then, so long ago, that that switch would, it would, what it was is a capacitive coupling. Because at that time, there were no diodes that I could afford. This was back in the 60s, that would switch at 1.2 gig or higher and give you anything that you could do anything with. I was wondering, if you wanted to build such a switch today, how would you do it? My second question is a simple one. Water getting into coax cable. If you're on UHF, you know it right away because you don't hear anything anymore and nobody can hear you. You find out very fast. But on the lower bands, you can have water in there and your SWR doesn't change at all. That's my experience. Is there a way to detect water without taking the thing apart? Say you have an antenna, you have the feed line attached to it on top of the tower. Is there any kind of instrumentation you could try to find out if you do have water that has gotten in your coax? I don't know the answer to this one. K2RIW, W2JPW.
We are very glad to, I was listening to you on the input, and you're nice and loud in my QTH. I was worried that you were going to time out the machine. Therefore, I was about to listen to the tail end of your question by listening on the input. But you didn't time it out. Your timing was perfect. Okay. Dickey switched radiometer is what I think you're describing. Many of the really good radio telescopes work by that function. In other words, if you're looking at a state-of-the-art, really dim star that's really far away, maybe the star with your radio telescope picks up an amount of noise that equals 1 degree Kelvin, 1 degree absolute temperature change of your antenna temperature when you wave your antenna on that star and off the star. And so can your radio telescope with high resolution resolve 1 degree Kelvin change? Well, if you're using a diode mixer front end because you're up at such a high frequency in the old days, where there is no good low noise preamplifier, and your receiver has a 1,000 degree Kelvin equivalent temperature. I'm not sure what the exact number is, but maybe that's a 10 decibel noise figure. And so you get a 1,000 degree Kelvin receiver, and it becomes 1,001 degrees when the antenna is aimed on the star, and it becomes 1,000 degrees when it's off the star. You know, you're looking for a 0.1% change in the noise power out of the receiver, and the receiver may have 1% change in its gain over a 10-minute period of time. So can you really resolve that with no ambiguity? Of course, the answer, doing it directly, is no. But if you're switching back and forth with a good switch where you know the insertion loss in the A mode and the B mode, so to speak, let me drop, and you know the insertion loss of the switch, and you carefully adjust the temperature of a 50-ohm resistor. You go up and down with this temperature by putting current through it or putting a heater on it or whatever, so that the noise power coming out of your standard load when you switch to it is identical to the noise power when you're aiming at the star. And if you're flipping the switch back and forth, let me pick a number, 400 times per second, That happens to be the rate at which you switch back and forth, so to speak, when you're doing an automatic noise figure indicator operation, which, by the way, is a Dickey switched radiometer. So what you're really doing is you're calibrating your receiver system, its noise, temperature, and its gain, 400 times per second. And so the power supply may be drifting up and down in voltage, your transistors may be drifting up and down in gain as they change temperature, but they can't do any of those things anywhere near fast enough compared to 400 switches per second. So therefore, with that Dickey switch radiometer with the right amount of gain, you can resolve extremely small differences in noise power. You could say that during the time your switch is on to the SAR, all the rectified voltage goes into capacitor number one. During the time your radio telescope is connected to its 50-ohm termination that you're heating up, you put all of that rectified voltage into capacitor two. Now you put an operational amplifier with a meter between measuring the voltage between capacitor one and capacitor two, measuring that difference. You make the difference go to zero, and now the noise temperature of your load and the noise temperature of the SAR are identical. And you can, because you're switching back and forth so fast and the gain of the receiver can't change that fast, you're calibrating the receiver 400 times per second, you could say, and it gives you some idea of why a Dickey-switched radiometer is such an extremely powerful tool. It allows you to measure 1 degree Kelvin out of a 1,000-degree Kelvin receiver. You could say you're digging 30 dB into the noise. That's what those numbers literally indicating. 1 degree Kelvin versus 1,000-degree Kelvin, it's a 30 decibel difference, 1,000-to-1 ratio. And you can easily resolve that with a good one. So the switch itself, I built a Dickey-switched radiometer 1 year ago for a particular project that I was doing for a client. I run a consulting business. A client needed to measure a very weak signal in the noise, and I built one of those. And what did I use for the switch? I can find out for you what brand name, but there is an integrated circuit, and it's probably five different brands. You go to the right brand name, and they will sell you a switching device, which has an on resistance of 1 ohm and an off resistance of a megohm, and it's got a T-squared L circuitry built into it. You feed it 5 volts. You give it a T-squared L command, which is your 400-cycle square wave in my particular case. In my case, it was a 1 megacycle. I was switching
repeater, timeout, cancel.
I was switching back and forth 1 million times per second. I was looking for a 1 megacycle signal buried in the noise. And by way of this switching device, which is an integrated circuit, I think it was Analog Devices, but I can double-check that one for you. I can find out the brand name, and you don't have to build it anymore. It's probably a $3 integrated circuit chip. It's a nice little pill with a bunch of wires coming out of it. You can mount it dead bug style if you like. In my case, I built a fancy printed circuit board around it, and it did the job like a charm. The only complaint I had is that I wanted to be able to measure a signal that, in my particular case, the signal was a sine wave of something like 5 volts. And the particular switching device, I think, really only went up to 3 volts before it started becoming nonlinear. It was using FET devices that doing the on-off switching, and if the actual signal flowing through the switch went beyond 3 volts, in the negative direction it started turning the FET off, in the positive direction it started saturating the FET, so I was getting a little bit of clipping action, and I think I had to cut down the gain before I went into the switch. So it's very similar to 30 years ago, if I wanted a state-of-the-art operational amplifier, Lou, I would build my own because you couldn't buy it. Now there are 30 brands of very high-performance operational amplifiers, some of them with dual differential input and dual differential output and extremely high voltage reject ratios and whatever, and you can get them for $3 a piece. You don't build an operational amplifier today. You buy it, and you need to choose the right brand name. So when it comes to the switch for Dickey switching, unless you're doing the switching at 10 gigahertz, and even there's probably a brand name I could go to, I recommend you choose the right brand name, you look at the right data sheet, and you buy it. So that's your question number one possible answer to that one. Let me drop it, I'll start going into question number two. Then I'm going to send it back to you, Lou, for you to find out what I really should have been answering. Stand by a second. Now, I, for one, have built some great big antennas. Take a look at the March issue, 2008, the 2008 March issue of CQ Magazine, the one that's on the newsstands at Barnes & Noble's right now. You go to page 34, and you will see K2RIW's array of 16 Yagis mounted on the top of 100 feet of tower, with him standing in the middle of it, and a little bit of an article that goes around it, showing you the antenna pattern and me on the tower and whatever, and what I was doing with that fancy piece of hardware. Anyhow, that array of 16 Yagis had about 20 pieces of cable in the phasing harness, and therefore it had about 40 type N connectors, and I worried myself sick about which of those 40 connectors are going to get water in them, and how much of the cable is going to get water in it, because at 432 megacycles, water, a couple of drops of water in the middle of a type N connector can give you 10 decibels of extra loss just in that one connector itself. So what I did is to make sure that all of the antennas were floating with reference to ground, the driven elements of all these Yagis. Therefore, I would sit in the shack with an ohmmeter. I would measure from center conductor to ground on my transmission line. And if I measured 10 megohms, I had a good day. I was happy. There was no water in the system. When the tiniest bit of water got in any one of those connectors, the ohmmeter would start coming down real fast. And when I got down to about 300 kilo-ohms, I knew I was in trouble. If I had a whole lot of water in there, I would come down to 50 kilo-ohms. And now I knew that the array is really going to behave very poorly, and I had to go up there and climb around and find out which of the connectors got water, unpack it, dry it out, pack it better again with tape and whatever. That was my modus operandi. And I thought I had it knocked. Boy, was I wrong. Because when I took the array down, Hurricane Gloria did that for me in 1985, I guess it was. Hurricane removed that, Gloria removed that antenna from the tower for me. And I measured all of those pieces of cable. And I found that every single one of them, the insertion loss had doubled or tripled. And it didn't necessarily show up on the ohmmeter. Let me drop and I'll explain. I was using what I thought was state-of-the-art cable back in 1980, which was Times Wiring Cable FM8, foam-filled RG8 diameter coax cable, very low insertion loss, but flexible foam-filled cable. Very high-quality looking stuff. Great big, thick outer jacket of polyvinyl chloride. Looked to me like the cable was not chintzy in any way. However, over the 4 years, 5 years that array was up in the air, very slowly, water vapor migrated through that outer polyvinyl jacket into the foam. And it didn't show up on an ohmmeter. The only way it would have showed up if I took down pieces of that phasing harness, put a signal into one end, and measure what comes out of the other end. A time domain reflectometer will not show you that insertion loss. An ohmmeter will not show you the insertion loss. That was closed cell foam for the dielectric of that cable, and the water vapor had slowly migrated through the outer jacket into that foam. You're about to say, okay, why don't you buy a better brand of cable? The only cable I know that doesn't have that characteristic is Hardline. Let me drop. When the outer jacket is a solid metallic object, now you stand a chance of achieving a very good weather seal and maybe a hermetic seal. And in the technical world, hermetic seal has a very exact meaning. It means you do a helium leak test, and only a few molecules of helium, the smallest molecule in the world, will slowly migrate through the glass joint of your seal, so to speak, or the welded joint, and you measure the rate of that, and you know how good is the sealing. When it comes to any kind of a rubber gasket that to you and me, when you're canning your food, you think the rubber gasket is giving you a real good seal. Yeah, it's giving you a fairly good weather seal. But the rate at which water vapor migrates through that seal is finite. It's very similar to what happens when you buy a helium balloon for your child and they connect it to the bedpost overnight, and the next morning the helium balloon is nowhere near as high as it used to be. The helium slowly migrates through the pores of the rubber of the balloon, and it's out. Well, water vapor does that. It just does it much more slowly. So unless you've got a metallic jacket, water is slowly migrated into every one of your flexible foam-filled cables that don't have an outer foil hermetic seal to them, and therefore the insertion loss is slowly climbing because very few substances have as bad a loss tension as water. Water makes an extremely good dummy load at UHF frequencies, not quite as bad at HF frequencies, and part of the way you can get away with it at HF frequencies is because, at least in the receive mode, the noise on the band is so high that the extra noise figure rise to your system because of the insertion loss of your transmission line. In the receive mode, doesn't matter. In the transmit mode, yes, it matters somewhat. It lowers the amount of power coming out of your transmitter that gets to the antenna. So I think the answer, Lou, is that unless you're using hardline and measuring with your ohm meter, the only other way you can confirm that your cable doesn't have excess loss is you've got to open up one end and measure the vis-wire of the reflected signal, or you open up one end and you pour power into one end and you measure the amount of power that comes out of the other end. That's the only foolproof manner. If I had a pool of water at one end of the cable, yes, my time domain reflectometer will show me a bump at that particular position on the cable. But if the water is slowly distributed throughout the foam of the cable as a continuous insertion loss that has doubled or tripled because the water vapor is in the foam, I know of no instrumentation without opening the ends of the cable that'll absolutely confirm that for you. That's sort of the bad news, Lou. Sorry to hear about that. W2JPW, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KY with a comment.
Stand by, Lou. Let's see what Mel's got to say. Because he lives by the seashore. Not only does he get water, he gets salt water, which is three times as bad as the fresh water I get here in Huntington. You got it, Mel.
It's WW3 for the comment.
Okay, Howie's going to be second. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. The TDA that AEA makes, you know, the one I purchased, you know, it has the graphic display. They call it a TD analyzer, time domain analyzer. They don't call it a TDR. I have tried it now. I had a piece of coax, and they explained that different things that show up in that graph that comes across the screen. And if you get water in the cable for, well, not immediately, but after a period of time when it starts to actually deteriorate, you split open the cable that has water in it. You look at the shield, it's like black, it's like deteriorating. In fact, a couple of times I found that the shield actually, powdered my hand, actually fell apart when I touched it. It was like really so deteriorated. Now, TDA, the AEA device, what it'll do, if the coax cable isn't continuous heat, somewhere, in other words, some reason the heat has changed somewhere down the line, you will find that it will indicate that. In other words, what is changing the heat? The only thing is usually like water migrating into it, has some way of shifting from what you see some way in your line, and it shows up like a little, like a double blip, they explain it, and I guess it does work, but it's got to be sufficient, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm going to both agree with you and disagree with you a little bit on this one, Mel. Without a doubt, when the cable is far enough in damage that you're starting to get interruption of the braid and corrosion of the braid and lack of conductivity of the braid and therefore a bump in the impedance, a time domain reflectometer or a time domain analyzer will show you that to you. However, I think Lou is concerned one or two steps back from that level of destruction. In other words, when the water is migrating into the foam of the cable or just a little bit of water is migrating into his connector, and at VHF frequencies, he's starting to lose performance of the system. That's what I think he's trying to detect. At two or three steps downrange, when the cable really starts becoming deteriorated, yes, a time domain reflectometer like thing will show it to you. But before you get to that point, you're still suffering the electronic damage in performance, but most instrumentation, other than opening up the cable and measuring what signal flows through, I don't know of instrumentation that's really going to show it to you. It's a very subtle effect. By the same token, if I wanted to go from coax cable to twin lead in a very broadband manner, and if I made a impedance tapered device where I cut a slit in the outer jacket of the cable, this is hardline, and as you go further and further down the cable, the slit becomes wider and wider, and eventually, very slowly, the cable becomes twin lead, I could make that cable work over multiple octaves as long as I got enough wavelengths of that taper. The good news about RF energy is that if, no matter what you do impedance-wise, If you do it slow enough, you don't get a reflection. Well, you can see the back door to that particular problem. If the water migrating into the foam of your cable does it slow enough, it's not just one great big chunk, bump of water in one spot. If it's a slow distribution of water down the cable, normal instrumentation is not going to show it as a phony reflection. Only measuring the insertion loss from end to end is going to show it to you. That's a strongly felt opinion on my part. Let's see what Howie's got to say to this one. Howie, I wonder if you've got water in your cables and some of your repeater systems. How do you detect it? You got it, Howie. K2RAW on the TechNet.
I got one more question, Dick. You'll come back to me.
Roger, Dodger. Howie first. Go ahead, Howie.
You just say, please. Can you hear me now? Dead battery. Dick, can you hear me this way?
I can hear you this way. Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, LMR 400 cable is the way to go. You don't get any real water in 400. The way I check my feed lines, or I've checked in the past, and guys do check it when they come up, we'll use a transistor, one of those high-end site masters, site analyzers, and you can find out the faults, and they'll tell you if you have any real problem. You'll look down the line, you'll see if the impedance changes, and you'll see if the SWR is veering across the line, because they'll tell you where the best SWR is. So, you know, using some, you know, techniques, you can definitely come up. But I will say this much, Dick. LMR 400, LMR 500, if you properly terminate that cable into the connectors and then properly weatherproof it, that cable can be direct buried. It can stay outside. They say that a 20-year lifespan. By the way, I've seen some cables just in the last day or so. It actually says Andrews Times Wave on it. Andrews bought out the other company. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to agree with you on this one, Howie. I've recently installed a couple of hundred feet of LMR 400 on my tower. Beautiful cable. And the reason why that flexible foam-filled cable doesn't have the problem, you slit open that outer black polyvinyl jacket and you look inside, and it has a foil layer, which I think is on top of the braid, or is it under the braid? I'm not sure which. But there's a foil layer between the outside world and that inner foam, which is a hermetic seal. So there's a real metallic seal. It's not just plastic trying to keep out the water vapor. And LMR is a beautiful product. I know that Richie N2EO has fallen in love with it. A number of other people. I think Barry N2 Mike Bravo has also fallen in love with that stuff. I've now recently fallen in love with it. Beautiful product. And so that's the one flexible foam-filled cable I know of, other than Hardline, that seems to have solved the water problem, as long as you do a good job of putting on the connectors. Mel, I know you wanted to make a further comment or question. K2KEY, K2RIW.
And that's what I was going to say. The PDR or PDA that the AEA puts out eventually does show it. If I was to make a careful measurement of the cable before I installed it with the PDA, in other words, would the PDA begin to show something like change in the length of the cable, you know, or the termination point, or I should say if I had it that the end was actually showing open, and I measured initially brand new cable, could I see and make notes on it? Could I see if these subtle changes as the cable began to absorb water, Dick? Do you think it would show some kind of subtle change in that it wouldn't indicate the right length as it did before, something that I've thought over?
You're on to something here. And by the way, you sound like my physician. He wants to do all kinds of fancy measurements of my body because he wants to take a baseline. And then, with that baseline, when there's very minor changes, the subtle differences, he wants to be able to resolve those differences. That's what you want to do. If you had a known good AEA TDA, time domain analyzer, time domain reflectometer, and you take very careful measurements of the apparent electrical length of your cable. In other words, if you do a real careful measurement, the TDA will always show you a bump at the first connector, maybe one or two bumps along the cable that are very minor because somebody put an extremely slight kink in it, and another bump at the connector at the end, and a particularly a bump where the antenna is located, because almost none of our antennas are broadband DC to light. The extremely brief pulse, let me drop, the extremely brief pulse that's put into a transmission line by a time domain reflectometer represents a band of frequencies that go from DC to multiple gigahertz. No antenna covers that whole frequency range. Therefore, to a time domain reflectometer, almost every antenna you and I put on the end of that cable represents a great big impedance bump. It may be a perfect 50 ohm match at your favorite frequency, but it's not a perfect 50 ohm match at all frequencies that the TDA is looking at simultaneously by that very brief pulse, that extremely sharp edge of the rise time of that TDA pulse. Therefore, it will show you the exact electrical length of your cable. Therefore, as water gets into your foam of your cable, the electrical length of the cable, because of the slower velocity factor of the water, the higher dielectric constant, even though it's slowly distributed and doesn't show up as a pure standing wave ratio, a pure S11 reflection coefficient on S parameters, but the apparent electrical length of the cable will shift. And yes, once you've got that baseline, and as long as your cable is not slowly stretching because it's being waved in the wind, and on a hot day it gets a little bit longer because the copper is expanding, except for those minor factors, and you take that baseline, yes, you will see the difference. Very few of us are quite that exacting. Although I am starting to say, inside of every good ham radio operator is a scientist trying to get out. Or nowadays, some of us are astronomers trying to get out. You know what I mean? So yes, without a doubt, careful enough measurements of baseline will show it to you. And as I said, you sound a little bit like my physician. Hey, Lou, your simple set of questions, look what you caused. W2JPW, he's having fun with us. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I have ways of doing that. I seem to get in trouble all the time by causing things. The right questions or the wrong ones, depending on your point of view. But, I agree with you, Jacob, as far as the TDA is concerned. Wish I could afford one. It's like sticking a stalk of celery into some food coloring or iodine or something. The capillary effect will bring that water all the way along that coax cable, or at least along a good portion of it, and it will diminish quite, gradually as you go along. So these measurements are going to be difficult to detect differences. And I don't know what you would see on the TDA. You might see some little something or other, but I have no experience with it, so I don't know. I would love, very much like to know about the Dickey switch, though. You said you got something that would work at, say, 1.2 gig or a little higher, and that, in that part of the radio spectrum, for $3, then can't go wrong. But I always have no idea where to find it. I haven't done much in construction in a long time, so I don't know where all the best solid-state switches and amplifiers and integrated circuits are to be found anymore. So if you have any clue as to where to look for it, I can go on the internet and finish it up, but if you could just give me a pointer or two, it would be appreciated. K2RIW is... Oh, I just wanted to tell you guys, you probably already know, but just in case anybody on here doesn't who likes astronomy, astrophysics, and cosmology, the History Channel has a wonderful program every Tuesday night at 9. Sometimes they start at 8 with the older ones, called The Universe. And very, very, very good. I enjoy it extremely. K2RIW in the group, W2JPW.
HWW, please, Dick.
How we recognize? Going to get to you in a second. I'm going to hit you with a trivia question, Lou. Carl Sagan had a series of 10 programs on astronomy. Why can't I think of the name of it? What was the name of that Carl Sagan series, Lou?
Oh, gee, it's Radopasmos 2. Cosmos. I can't think of it either, Dick.
It's Cosmos.
I haven't seen it in years. Go ahead.
But while you were talking, three people gave us the answer. Cosmos. Very well done series. And I like the music that was in that one, too. And so, glad to hear that the History Channel is doing that. when Lou, when Mel and I look over our mail that we get, the email that we get, whenever we get into the subject of astronomy, we get quite a bit of favorable email. So hidden inside of many a serious ham radio operator, from my point of view, is a guy who really wants to understand something more about cosmology and astronomy. Where in the world did all of this stuff, where in the universe did all of this stuff come from? How did it get here? What's going to happen? Are we alone? I am convinced we're not alone. Absolutely convinced. I didn't say we're going to talk to an extraterrestrial tomorrow morning. And we're going to have the great big QSO between the stars in the next year. I know that that's not going to happen. But I know we're not alone. And I can give you a whole lot of reasons as to why that's true. As you dig deeper and deeper into trying to understand this universe, this galaxy, this galactic cluster, this solar system, our planet, whatever, it becomes stranger and stranger. I mean, this so-called dark energy, which is taking all this stuff out of the perimeter of the observable universe and pushing it away from us at an accelerating speed. What in the world is doing that? I've got my own little explanation. Each time I go to an astronomy meeting and I express it, they say, no, that's too simple, that can't be it. Well, you wait and see. I give you a 50-50 chance I might be onto something. Let's see, let me think now. The names of the companies that make switching devices, single pole, double throw, single pole, double pole, double throw, whatever, electronic switching devices appropriate for radiometry service and synchronous detector service. Was it Analog Devices? Was it Silicon Laboratories? Was it Maxim? I'm not sure. Was it Texas Instruments? All of these guys make some very good high-class chips, upper-amp type chips and switching type chips and voltage regulators and so on. And so all I've got to do is open up the box where I put all of that material in. It's at the salt mine. I'll try to do that tomorrow morning. So when I come back next week, if you haven't already found, and maybe I'll even send you an email, when I find the brand name of the particular switch I used. The switch wasn't ideal, but it was a lot better than what I could have built. My problem was I wanted to measure a 5-volt sine wave very accurately by switching. And so, as I remember, the particular switching device I was using, when you went beyond a couple of volts, it started becoming nonlinear. But as long as you're measuring small signals, like at the front end of a receiver, I think this thing can do the job for you rather nicely. And there was a number of model numbers of different switching rates and different on-off resistances and different rise times and fall times and so on. And the one I was choosing, because my case, I wanted to switch back and forth when he dropped. I wanted to switch back and forth a million times per second very accurately. So I was looking for only a few nanoseconds of ride time and a few nanoseconds of fall time. I think I finally selected a switching device that had something like 8 nanoseconds, as I remember, was the switching time. And I was switching in 500 nanosecond intervals by making square waves out of a 1 megacycle signal that I wanted to very accurately sample. And this device did the job, except for that voltage limiting characteristic, it did the job very nicely. And it was T-squared L commandable. So, I'm sure you can find schematics of how to build, but I don't think you have to. There's some very nice chips out there where somebody has already done the job for you of exactly balancing the two different sides of the switch, if you know what I mean. And that's part of what gives you the accuracy of the radiometry approach. You would like the on resistance in switch mode A and switch mode B to be identical. You'd like the off resistance to be close to infinity. And you'd like the switching time to be zero. It is like it to respond very nicely to your T-squared L commanding signal. And I found a chip that came close to meeting all of those criteria at the megacycle switching rate, which satisfied my operation. The average guy doing radiometry doesn't have to switch anywhere near a million times per second. 400 times per second is all you need for operating a good automatic noise figure indicator. Now, one other thing I wanted to mention to you, Lou, and that is you were dreaming that you wish you had a time domain reflectometer. One of the things that makes me very disappointed is that particular instrument. Let me drop.